The bulk of the movie, The Usual Suspects, consists of Verbal Kint telling a detective a tale. But what led him to being one of only two surviving members of a fire on a ship that was docked at the port of Los Angeles? Only at the very end of the film does the detective realize that Kint has been feeding him a tall tale, constructed from random documents and photos on the detective's bulletin board.
Convince me. Tell me every
last thing. Back when I was in that barbershop quartet, Skokie, Illinois.
Where's your head, Agent Kuyan?
What we need to do is think. Think back.
I'm sure you've heard many tall tales.
In the early 1990s, Philadelphia had its own version of Verbal Kint. His name is James White, and he's an informant. Over the course of 12 months and 8 known statements, he told wildly differing stories implicating both himself and others in 6 different murders across Philadelphia. Many of his accounts led to acquittals at trial. Others have ended in exonerations years later. This is the story of 3 of those murders and one of the men who remains behind bars for crimes that he allegedly committed at the age of 16. His name is Theophilus Wilson, and he often goes by Theo. Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and this is a special episode of Undisclosed. Let's start by going back in time to North Philadelphia on the evening of September 25th, 1989. On that night, Otis Reynolds was found dead of a gunshot wound to the head. His associates, brothers Kevin and Gavin Anderson, were also found dead a few miles away the next morning. The 3 men were all Jamaicans and all involved in drug dealing. And that led to a man known as Step Light becoming the initial prime suspect in their murders. Here's Jenny Merrigan, the attorney for Theo Wilson.
And if we can go back to 1989... in September, that is when Otis Reynolds is found dead, and the next morning, Kevin and Gavin Anderson are also found dead. And my understanding from your filings is there's an initial suspect who is then abandoned by the police. Is that correct?
That's correct. And just to be clear, that initial suspect who... the police call the quote-unquote the prime suspect, that is never revealed to trial counsel. And that document, which calls him the prime suspect, is never disclosed until the DA's office disclosed their file to us in this year.
Right. And if you can explain in those files that are disclosed, what's the evidence that makes him initially the prime suspect?
What makes him the prime suspect is, from what we can gather from the files, that the victims were involved in drug trafficking in North Philadelphia, and they were Jamaican. One of them was from Jamaica, and the other two were of Jamaican descent. They identified themselves, as far as we can tell, as operating with the Jamaicans in the Philadelphia drug trade. The prime suspect, who his nickname was Step Light, Step Light was a drug kingpin. He operated a number of stores in North Philadelphia, and at some point in the months before the murders, a conflict arose between the victims and Stoplight. And we know this from witness statements, some of which were suppressed, which discuss a shootout between the 3 victims and Stoplight at one of Stoplight's stores. And then we know this because the 3 victims committed a very brutal robbery of a drug house that was on Stoplight's block, that was on a block where his family lived and where he owned at least one drug house that we know of.
The case against Stoplight seemed pretty strong. Indeed, the day after the murders, an associate or employee of Stoplight was found with several items belonging to one of the victims, Otis Reynolds.
One specific employee or associate of Stoplight, we learned, actually had one of the victim's possessions on him, and that was never revealed to the trial counsel. And in fact, there was no chain of custody with regard to the victim's belongings, and these included his identification, his passport, a phone bill, pretty important documents that you know, might expect that he would have on his person.
But for whatever reason, the police eventually dropped Stepley as a suspect, and the case went cold. But then, a couple years later, the police interviewed a 14-year-old pregnant girl about an unrelated homicide.
James White Joy, do you want to speak to the beginning of how James White comes into their focus, it appears, because the police are interviewing a 14-year-old pregnant girl about one of the other unrelated homicides. And she starts talking about her friend or boyfriend, James White. She is an extremely vulnerable witness. And it looks from the files that we've reviewed that she starts talking about James White after about 8 hours of questioning. So that's sort of how we think that James White initially became involved.
The police then brought in James White, who confessed to the murder. And then they asked him about other murders, including the murders of the Jamaicans. White eventually confessed to 6 murders in all. His confession to the murders of the Jamaicans in particular sounds like something that might have come out of the mouth of Verbal Kin. According to White, he and some accomplices decided to set up the Jamaicans in a fake arms deal and then rob them. When the Jamaicans came to the fake arms deal, White and his associates then kidnapped them, took their money, held them hostage, and eventually shot them in vans and threw their bodies from the vans while they were driving. While White's narrative shifted, he eventually implicated 3 men. Rick Bennett, who was acquitted at trial, Chris Williams, who was exonerated a couple of weeks ago, and Theo Wilson, whose parents were friends with Chris Williams. Bennett and Williams were both older, while Wilson was a 16-year-old high school student known as Binky at the time of the murders. So how did White come to implicate him?
James White says to the police in a statement, Binky bought us food. And so he's saying that everybody was involved in planning one of the other many murders, and that Binky bought them food. And then that's the first time that we see Binky's name. And then he starts saying afterwards, when the other prisoner implicates him in the murder of the Jamaicans, and according to James White's testimony, the DA then says to him, well, you better cooperate with me on this, or, we'll try you capitally for these, because now we have you for these 6 murders. And so then he starts weaving this really nonsensical story. And in this one, Binky is supposedly present in a warehouse when the defendants are going to rob the victims. And then he's never accused of committing any murders, but he's driving in a separate car. He's driving a separate car in front of the van where the defendants are supposedly shooting the victims in the head and throwing them out of the van.
So what was Theo Wilson's life like back in 1989? Here's his attorney, Jenny Merrigan.
So at the time that the crime occurred, Theo was in high school. And he was, from what we've gathered in our pretty limited investigation, a good kid. We found teachers who knew him and remembered him, including a kindergarten teacher who her first words out of her mouth were, Binky, of course I remember Binky, which is Theo's nickname. So he was in high school. He graduated from high school shortly after the crime occurred, and he was not involved in, he was not involved in the sort of the criminal enterprise that the prosecution tried to accuse him of being involved in. He was significantly younger than his co-defendant, I think about 20 years younger, and was kind of just a kid graduating from high school.
And here's Theo himself.
Well, it's like a typical teenager, loving sports and know, having fun and just, you know, just living the life of a teenager, you know. School and just having fun.
However, this blissful teenage innocence was interrupted in 1992 when Theo was visited by homicide detectives.
Yes, it was, I believe, 3 months before I was arrested, when homicide detectives came to my mother's house and asked me to, would I come talk to him, and I volunteered and went and talked to him. And that was the first time that I actually heard of them after they questioned me about some other things. And then they popped that on me. And that was the first time that I actually heard of these individuals.
And so what was that like for you? You're sitting at home. You have no idea about these murders, and these homicide detectives come and take you away to question you. What do you remember about that?
Well, it was it's something that I shouldn't have done. I've come to learn that innocent people put themselves in bad situations. Just being straightforward and sincere. The things that I know now, I probably wouldn't have went with them. But I went with them, trying to figure out, you know, what was going on. And they questioned me about some things. I told them I didn't know nothing about those things. And then they mentioned that this particular individual, James White, had implicated me in 3 murders. That's how I learned about it. My jaw hit the floor. I was a bunch of mixed emotions. Scared, afraid, trying to figure out what's going on, perplexed. And that was the beginning of my nightmare, you know?
The next day, Theo was called back in to discuss the case with the detectives and Assistant District Attorney David Desiderio. Theo again said that he knew nothing about the murders.
And a very strange thing happened. They admitted that they knew that the guy was lying on me.
Mm-hmm.
He told me I'll probably spend about a year or so in my life in the penitentiary. So it was kind of like, it was kind of crazy at the time, you know, thinking about, if you know I don't have nothing to do with the crime, you know, why is you taking me through all this here? And they basically answered that, you know, they said they wanted Christopher Williams. And they wanted me to help them get him. And I said, well, I don't know nothing about Christopher Williams committing any crimes. So they said, okay, we're going to let you go, but we'll be back at you.
Despite this threat, as the weeks passed, Theo began to feel a bit comfortable.
And through that time, and then the months that went past, maybe about 1 or 2 months, the feeling started to subside in terms of my worry and my panic, because I'm figuring, okay, they figured this guy was lying, and that was that. But 3 months later, they came and arrested me, man, so, and charged me with the crime, came to my mother's home without incident, and I gave up to him, and here we are.
And so you mentioned a minute ago about when they arrested you. Can you go into a little bit more detail about the day that they arrested you and what you remember?
Well, what I remember is that several detectives came to my mother's apartment where I was staying at and knocked on the door and came in there and arrested me and took me down to the police headquarters, questioned me about my alleged involvement in these crimes. They tried to use my mother and my mother's boyfriend against me, together and one at a time. And I told my mother and her boyfriend, I said, listen, man, I don't know nothing about what they're talking about. You know, this is crazy. So after that, they asked me who was my attorney. Did I have an attorney? I told them no. And they booked me.
And you're how old at this point?
I think 19 years old at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, they locked me up in 1992.
And so you're put in jail with a bunch of adults, right?
Yes.
And what's that experience like when you're put in jail for the first time?
Well, we're just scared, you know, scared. And I mean, it's hard to explain, you know, all the different emotions and all the different, it's difficult, but, you know, just, you know, shocked. Shocked is the best word I can explain it.
Eventually, Theo's case proceeded to trial. There were only two witnesses against him, James White and a man named David Lee.
And David Lee testified for the prosecution that he had sold guns to Chris Williams and Theo, and that he testified basically that they had what the prosecution was calling an ongoing criminal enterprise.
After the state rested, Theo took the witness stand in his own defense, but his testimony didn't go how you might expect.
I took the stand in my own defense, and they never questioned me about the homicides. For the 2 days I was on the stand, there was something else that was perplexing to me. I was like, well, you know, I'm going to get found not guilty, right? And then the jury came back after some, the closing arguments, and they found me guilty. And then we was on to the death penalty phase.
And what's going through your head and your heart when essentially you know in this hearing they're deciding whether to give you the death penalty?
As I said, shocked, can't believe it, still hurting from them finding me guilty, and now thinking, they get ready to try to kill me, about a crime I didn't commit. Just being in there and it's like being in a suspended animation. You just can't believe the whole situation. And, it's like this stuff is really happening to me. Took the stand. Family and friends testified. I testified. They tried to get me to plead for my life. I told them that, I'm innocent and I'll be back. I didn't get up there and plead for my life. I didn't get up there and show any remorse, because remorse is for people who was guilty. So I didn't get up there with that. I got up there and I told him I'll be back. Here we are.
And so, at the age of 19, Theo was sentenced to a life behind bars.
And so then, taking it back to the early 90s, what are those first few years in prison like for you?
But it was rough. It was rough. More mental than anything. Waking up every day, knowing that you're innocent, and having to deal with things that you shouldn't have to deal with. Being away from your family. Being in a situation, man, your life didn't take they took your life from you. Tried to put you on death row, and just trying to maintain. So what I decided to do was turn jail into Yale and prison into Princeton, and be motivated in that regard, and just get down to this law library and make my mind up right then and right away, right then and there, that I was going to get out of jail. So that's what I did. I dedicated my life to the law, studying law. So that kept me sane.
Almost every juvenile locked up racks up disciplinary infractions as he adjusts to life in prison. But Theo was the exception. Again, here's Jenny Merrigan.
We heard the nickname was from a correctional officer who, we were going to see him at the jail and said to us, or at the prison, and the CO said to us, you're here for Binky's case, like, what's going on? And I'm not used to CO's calling my clients by their childhood nicknames. It was pretty revealing, honestly, of kind of how people feel about Theo, which is genuinely warm and good. He's just a genuinely warm and good person. He's been at the prison, he's been incarcerated in Pennsylvania since the time of his arrest, and so it's been over 27 years, and he's never had a single disciplinary infraction in all of that time, which is incredibly significant. I mean, prisoners get disciplinary infractions for all kinds of act activities or in, you know, inactivities. They could sleep through count. They could not stand up when a CO asked them to stand up. They could have an extra pair of socks or an extra stamp. These are all things that you can get written up for. And Theo's never even had one of those in substantial write-ups. And so it's pretty significant.
For two decades, Theo Wilson remained behind bars. But then he caught a break. In 2013, James White recanted his testimony against his co-defendants and him. According to White, Assistant District Attorney David Desiderio had met with him multiple times outside of his counsel's presence, sometimes one-on-one and sometimes for lunch with his mother, and sometimes by telephone, as corroborated by telephone records as well as body warrants. According to White, Desiderio incentivized, coerced, and fed him information about many murders. White claimed that together, the men pieced together fictitious accounts of multiple murders, including the murders of the Anderson brothers and Reynolds. Theo Wilson's co-defendant, Christopher Williams, who'd been given a death sentence, was able to use that testimony by White to get his conviction thrown out. But because Theo was given a life sentence, he was out of appeals and out of luck. But White's recantation isn't the only thing supporting Theo's innocence. Recall James White's testimony about his accomplices and him shooting the victims and throwing their bodies out of moving vans. Well, it turns out the physical evidence in this case renders this story physically impossible. I spoke with Robert Tressel, the former chief criminal investigator at the Cobb County District Attorney's Office in Marietta, Georgia.
I just remember that the biggest thing was that it was a lack of injuries that first drew my attention to whether these guys were actually thrown out of the back of a moving van or not.
Right, and so the claim here is that at least two of the victims are shot in this moving van and thrown out. And when you're saying the lack of injuries, what specifically are you pointing to that you would have expected to see?
Well, I'd expect to see abrasions, injuries of sliding across pavement. Of course, it's in the wintertime, so they got heavy clothing on, so you have to look at the clothing more than you do the body. But they don't have any injuries consistent with tumbling, flailing of arms and legs. Nothing that is consistent with coming out of a moving vehicle. Their clothing is pristine, other than some blood staining.
Yeah, and this was an issue that came up a bit in your testimony in terms of the tumbling. And so if we have someone who's shot in a moving van and they're thrown out of the moving van, we would expect to see some tumbling. They wouldn't just sort of fall and remain in a stationary position.
Right. Now, if I step out of the car that stopped and just kind of pushed out, you may not see any injuries depending on what the surface is. But if the vehicle's moving at any significant speed, whether it be 5 miles an hour or 30 miles an hour, you're going to start seeing some abrasions. Mostly to the exposed skin tissues, face, hands, sometimes their arms, and also looking for any other injuries that might get, broken bones associated with the tumbling, rolling into curbs, rolling into cars, because I can't remember off the top of my head which one's under the car, under the front end of the vehicle.
And so you're saying this would happen even if it's only traveling at a rate of, say, 5 miles per hour?
Yeah, they still get... You have to take the fact that they got linear motion, and they're moving at the same speed the vehicle is when they come out.
Right.
And until they reach enough resistance from striking the road surface, they're going to roll or tumble to rest.
Right. And when you said you didn't see these, abrasions or marks, etc., is that telling you this is highly unlikely that this happened, or is this something you can essentially rule out as having happened?
If I remember right, in the PCR hearing, I said I ruled it out. They did not come out of a moving vehicle. The most probability is they were shot right where they were found.
But that's not the only reason that Tressel regards White's story as physically impossible. Another reason is that there was only one blood flow pattern on the victims' bodies. According to White, this wouldn't and couldn't happen if the victims were shot and then thrown from a moving van.
Yeah, you should see what I call multiple flow patterns.
Uh-huh.
In this case, there's not multiple flow patterns, direction, one direction.
And so in other words, the point there being that if they're shot in one location, the blood flow starts, and then when they're thrown, that leads to the secondary pattern.
Correct. It changes the flow of the blood.
Uh-huh.
And you can see that in multiple ways. A perfect example is a crime scene where the first person that gets there or finds the victim rolls them over.
Uh-huh.
So let's say they're face down and rolls them over on the back. Now you're going to get a secondary blood flow.
Right.
Because their position has been changed.
And so then in terms of the blood flow pattern here, you would say not only were they not thrown from a moving van, but at least when there was still blood flow, they weren't flipped over. They weren't moved from where they were initially shot.
Exactly. Everything looks consistent with where all three of these individuals were found.
And that's not all. Remember the second and only other witness against Theo, David Lee? Well, it turns out there are problems with him as well.
And he also argued, and the DA reinforced this to the jury, that he was, quote-unquote, squeaky clean. He had never even had a parking ticket. And he was here in court because, you know, he was seeing what was escalating between these defendants, and he felt that he needed to stop it, right? It was like his duty to say something. So the conflict of interest comes in because, in fact, David Lee was not squeaky clean. He had been implicated in and used as a witness in two other murders, and he was heavily implicated in the murders. The police found David Lee when they went to one of the victim's bodies. It was directly in front of David Lee's house, and the victim's brother was screaming into the house, "David Lee, you didn't have to do this. You could have gotten money some other way." So police identify him, and they bring him to the station, and they start questioning him, and he knows a lot about this murder and the feud between the defendant and the victim. Then, through questioning other witnesses, they find out that the defendant in that case was connected to another unsolved murder, and David Lee was in the car when this drive-by shooting was committed, and David Lee was possibly driving the car. So they bring him in again, and he says yes, that he was there, and he actually turns over bullets from the gun that the murder was committed with. Lee is never charged. He is, as far as we can tell, never arrested, and he participates in the prosecution of the defendant.
Simply put, this was vital impeachment evidence that the defense could have used to undermine the squeaky clean image that Lee claimed he had at trial. And the prosecutor at Theo's trial knew this information because he was involved in one of these cases. Maybe more importantly, the same was true for Theo's defense counsel.
So, at Theo's trial, David Desiderio was the prosecutor. And so he certainly knew that David Lee had been a cooperating witness who was heavily implicated in two other murders. Also at Theo's trial, Jack McMahon was the defense attorney. So Jack McMahon absolutely knew that David Lee was a witness for the prosecution in a prior crime and heavily implicated in those murders. Neither McMahon nor Desiderio revealed that fact to the court or to Theo. For McMahon, this is a pretty serious, I mean, it's obviously a serious ethical violation. He was in an actual conflict of interest. He had obtained confidential information by virtue of his former employer, and the professional rules of conduct required that he go to the DA and get authorization to reveal that confidential information.
And then there's also evidence that was unknown to both Theo and his attorney at trial.
The prosecution suppressed 911 call in which a gas station employee reported that someone had just knocked on his gas station window and said that a man had been shot at 32nd and Burke, which is the exact location where Kevin Anderson's body was found. Kevin Anderson's body was not actually found until about 8 hours later. And so, you know, the police marked that call unfounded, but it is unclear as to how that happened. But they did not turn over that report, and that report, you know, did show that somebody saw someone being shot in the street and not in a van. Nor is there any indication that there was a van nearby. There was a second eyewitness who approached officers while they were processing the scene of Gavin Anderson's death, and he told them that he had seen the victim that morning arguing with a man that he recognized from the neighborhood. Two things happened with this report. The first is that police went back to him unbeknownst to trial counsel, and they actually got the name of the man who he saw. So this eyewitness identified this potential assailant. Then police marked that as unfounded because they said that the eyewitness had reported seeing the altercation too late, and that according to the ME's report, rigor would have already set in by then. So the eyewitness must have been mistaken. In fact, when we went back and looked at the reports, it appears as though the police actually confused the ME reports for the two victims, and that rigor had not set in for Gavin Anderson, but had set in for Kevin Anderson, which makes sense because that gas station attendant had called about 8 hours before his body was actually found.
Right. And so, while Theo was out of options in court, a name familiar to undisclosed listeners stepped in, Larry Krasner. His conviction integrity unit, run by Patricia Cummings, took an interest in his case and agreed to a hearing that could result in Theo being exonerated. I asked Theo about how he felt about that hearing.
Well, I'm nervous, but cautiously optimistic. And, you know, hoping and praying that everything works out and I get some justice.
As Theo notes, these hearings can go either way. You never know what a judge will do, even when a CIU is involved. And so, Theo's attorney worked with Patricia Cummings and the CIU on joint stipulations. These are facts where there's agreement between both the prosecution and the defense. There are 105 of them in this case, including first, the parties stipulate the Commonwealth did not disclose that they were investigating a prime suspect known as Steplight. Second, the parties stipulate that numerous investigative documents pertaining to other alternate suspects were not disclosed until 2019. And third, the parties stipulate that the district attorney's office and counsel for the defense were aware that David Lee had cooperated with the Commonwealth in prior murder prosecutions in order to avoid punishment or curry favor. And so, with all the evidence of Theo's innocence and all these joint stipulations, today, January 21st, 2020, the judge declared that Theo is innocent and will be a free man. And now, he can finally do what he's been waiting to do for decades.
And if the hearing goes well, if you are able to get your release, what do you hope to do upon being released?
Well, get some rest. You know, I'm tired. I rarely get any rest. I haven't slept good in 28 years, 27 going on 28 years. And then be with my family and friends and try to help some people that's in the same situation I'm in to get some justice. And, you know, just live a peaceful life.
Thanks for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. And thanks to my research assistant, AC Parham, for her work in this case. We'll be back in March with a whole new series investigating another wrongful conviction in Pennsylvania.